Well, good evening. I'm Mary Nichols. I'm Dean of the College of Continuing Education. It's a real pleasure to welcome you to the final headliners of the season tonight. It's been quite a year. We've witnessed the long, contentious debate over healthcare reform. It's sort of over, I guess, right? The escalating war in Afghanistan, which is certainly long from over. The demise of newspapers nationwide. And, of course, the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. We've been fortunate to hear from experts at the center of all these issues, but for all of us, each month, it's been your questions and comments that have shaped the discussions. So for this reason, too, I'm hoping that you'll be willing to share your opinions with us one more time. Next week, you'll receive a short survey by email asking you about your headliner's experience. So I hope you'll take a few minutes when you get that to share your thoughts with us about this program. And as always, your input and insights will help us make headliners the very best that it can be. I think it's important for all of us, whether we've been away from school for a few years or a few decades, should we say, to have these kinds of opportunities to engage with scholars, challenge our assumptions, and keep our minds sharp. That's why the College of Continuing Education presents a series like Headliners. While we're more widely known perhaps for helping adults return to school or come back to finish a degree or pursue their professional education, we also host what we think is the most robust collection of personal enrichment programs available. So before Headliners returns in the fall, I hope you'll try some of our other upcoming events that you've seen in front of you here tonight. And in keeping with tonight's topic on frugality, they're a high-quality experience and a great value. Enough of a pitch. Our speaker this evening is a respected personal finance expert, well known to all of us who listen to Minnesota Public Radio. But his reputation extends well beyond our community. In addition to serving as NPR Senior Economics Editor, Chris Farrell is Chief Economics Correspondent for American Public Media's Documentary Unit. He's a contributing editor for Business Week magazine, a regular contributor to the Marketplace Morning Report, as well as the resident economics editor for Marketplace Money. He served as the host and executive editor of Right on the Money, the long-running nationally syndicated public television program, and wrote its companion book, Right on the Money, Taking Control of Your Personal Finances. That was in 2000. He's also the author of Deflation, What Happens When Prices Fall, as well as a weekly column for the Star Tribune. Mr. Farrell is a graduate of Stanford University and the London School of Economics. Among his many honors are a National Magazine Award, two Gerald Leib Awards in Business Journalism for his radio documentaries, and the prestigious Edward R. Murrow Award. Tonight, he'll discuss the topic of his latest book, The New Frugality, and we'll sign copies of his book immediately following his presentation. I've already got mine signed. Will you please join me in welcoming Chris Farrell?
Well, thank you. And this is really a great honor. It's a great pleasure to be here. And I'd like to make some remarks about the book, the thesis of The New Frugality, and then open it up for questions, because it's always a little bit disconcerting. You're real people. And usually I'm in a studio, and maybe there's an engineer, but usually I'm just sort of looking out of, this, out of the window of Studio 4D. You look into the next-door parking lot, and I'm connected by an ISDN line to somebody. You're here. So when we open it to questions, it'll be much more like the radio. What I want to argue is that we're living through a time where, for households managing their money, this is a major sea change, major transformation that we're going through. Now, when I started covering Wall Street in the early 1980s, I quickly learned that the easiest way to earn the scorn of a Wall Street veteran, they would just roll their eyes, furrow their brow, would be to say to them, this time is different. And they quote the famous sentence from Sir John Templeton, who was the mutual fund pioneer, and he would say that the four most dangerous words in the English language are, this time is different. So, I'm going to argue this time is different. And what, you know, if you were just to really boil it down, that an era of consumer borrowing is over, and an era of frugality is starting. And what I'm going to do is support this thesis, and I think there's a combination of negative forces that are pushing us in this direction and positive forces that are pushing us in this direction. And part of this I'm going to look at, and I say I'm going to focus on the household because that's where the epicenter of changes are going on. So let's just start with the background. Before we even got to the Great Recession, we've essentially, if you look at the business cycle expansion of the 2000s, you could almost call it the lost decade. You know, in Japan, when its bubble burst and it fell into sort of a stagnation, a deflationary stagnation, it was called the lost decade. And if you look back at the business cycle expansion of the 2000s, well, it was our lost decade. Essentially, the stock market went nowhere. We're getting pretty close to all the gains in the housing market have disappeared. Job growth during that period of time was about 1% at an average annual rate, which for a business cycle expansion was the worst of the post-World War II period. And real household income fell, wages stagnated. And if you really want to be upset and, you know, sort of looking at the where we are on a university campus, the real wages adjusted for inflation of young college graduates, 24 to 35, fell by about 11% during that period of time. And these are people who did the right thing. So that's the environment that we're in. And then we move ourselves into, you know, a great bubble, a great borrowing bubble, and then the bubble bursts, and we sink into a great recession. And I'm in the camp that believes that we did stare at the abyss, that we were on the brink of a Great Depression. And through extraordinary actions by the Federal Reserve, fiscal policy stimulus, bank bailout, holding your nose, a lot of disgusting things happened here and abroad. We averted a crisis. We averted a Great Depression. We obviously had a crisis. And the economy does appear to be recovering. It's showing up in the GDP, the gross domestic product statistics. You can kind of see in the rebound that's going on in the manufacturing sector. But it's going to take a long time to show up how most of us define the economy, which is in the job market. And this is going to have some implications also, longer term, for how we manage our money and think about frugality. So we went through this lost decade. But here's part of it. You know, if you look at previous business cycle expansions, you know, people during the downturn would say, I'm going to be thrifty. I'm going to be frugal. And for those of you who like history and sort of an early era internet initiative, Time Inc. put everything for free of its archive online. And it's just a wonder, you know, no one would do it today. But this is what they did. So if you want to know what people were saying in the 1930s, it's really a great resource. It's got a good search engine. So it's really, or you want to look what they were saying coming out of previous recessions, which is what I did. You kind of get a good feel for what people are talking about. So people are always talking about we're going to be thrifty, we're not going to borrow as much as we did before. Of course, we come out of the recession and we have the recovery and we would borrow more and save less. And then we sort of were continuing to go up. But, you know, it wasn't completely crazy. Because if you look at the business cycle expansion of the 1970s, real household income rose by 4.5%. The real business cycle expansion of the 1980s, 6.5%. The 1990s, 8.3%. The business cycle expansion of the 2000s, it fell by 0.6%. So part of what's going on, and only a part of it, but part of it was people were borrowing expecting that they were going to get the sort of income gains that would justify the borrowing that they were doing. And of course, those expectations were truly dashed. And the other things I think that, and of course, then we went out, we tried to make it up with some borrowings, and that went bad. And the banks lent to us like crazy. I mean, they took leave of their senses. As Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan, said, is, you know, we gave people weapons of mass destruction. Just happened to be borrowing. So there was ample credit that was available. But again, back to the household. So we had this disappointing real household income, but it also made apparent a trend that has been going on for the past three decades. The fact of the matter is, over the past three decades, with a very brief period of time, between 1995 and 2000, wages, when you're looking at compensation, you're looking at wages, you do it hourly, you do it annually, you include benefits, adjusted for inflation, we just haven't had that much of a gain for the past three decades. That's been the background. But we are a much wealthier society. we are much wealthier. And it wasn't all financed by a debt mirage. Well, what happened? Back in 1968, 38% of married women between the ages of 24 and 54 with children worked out of the house. That's now over 70%. And so what we did is we became the two-income household with children. And that's where a lot of the gain came from. Now, not only is that now plateaued at around 70%, but we're also, we work compared to 1968, this couple, they're working 20% more hours. So we're not going to get another income kick. We can't really work many more hours. I think, you know, it's pretty clear that the trend, the extra income kick from the two-income couple has petered out. And you cannot send the nine-year-olds to work. So you've all said, we've all said, you know, we want to live within our means. Well, guess what? I think that's what we're going to have to do because there is no extra income there. Now, the other thing is we now have a 9.7% unemployment rate. We're going to get the numbers tomorrow. Hopefully, it's going to be a better number. Nevertheless, the unemployment rate is really high. And if you use your broadest measure of unemployment, which includes not only people who are officially unemployed, but the people who want to be working 40 hours a week, but they can only get 28 hours a week. Or the people who, you know, they get a contract for 2 months, and they're working. And then for 2 months, they don't have a contract, then they get another contract. All right, that's 16.8% of our population. So in that environment, how many people imagine they're going to be able to walk into the boss's office and say, give me a 10% raise or I'm walking across the street? And by the time she picks herself up off the floor, stops laughing, she's going to sputter out and say goodbye. And that's the environment that we're in. Now, the other thing that happened is a great taboo was broken during the Great Recession. Now, this is a forecast, but I think it's pretty accurate. So companies don't like to cut wages, and they haven't liked to cut wages. This is what economists love to study. Why don't companies? Because economists, you cut wages, right? But the companies don't like to do it. And so the basic theory is that when you do layoffs, you concentrate the pain. When you cut wages, everybody's miserable. So it's bad for productivity. But we've had a period of time where if you go back to the 50s and the 60s, the era of corporate loyalty, and then you go into the 1970s, you started to have bigger layoffs. And then in the recession of the early 1980s, companies embraced the mass layoff. And in 1986, Business Week, during the expansion, ran a cover story called The End of Corporate Loyalty. Because what we learned was even in good times, when a company got into trouble, it embraced mass layoffs. That became a routine part of management's toolkit. So what happened this time? We had a little bit in the recession that, you know, turned out to be shallow, but you never really know if it's going to be shallow, of the early 2000s, where a lot of benefits were cut, and there were a little bit of pay freezes, a little bit of furloughs. This time around, there were real benefit cuts for many companies, and there were pay cuts, pay freezes, and furloughs. And so what companies have learned is that's what they need to do when times are tough. And so I think even during the business cycle expansion, and one of the things I tested this thesis out, I gave a talk over at the Humphrey Institute, and it was 134 human resources executives in a leadership position, major corporations. And I was hoping that they'd get up and say, no, you're wrong. Not one of them disagreed. Not one. So what have we learned during the Great Recession? We've all learned how financially fragile we are. We all learned how much we need to improve our own safety net. Now, we've had a major expansion in the safety net, which is really for the first time. And the safety net's been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking over the past three decades. We just had a major expansion in the safety net with healthcare reform. But that's still going to take time to work its way out. We don't exactly know how it's going to work out. There's a lot of details to be figured out and with time going. But that is a major expansion of the safety net. Nevertheless, people now realize that they need to save more. And it's becoming more of the anecdotal conversation. People are talking about it. You can see it a little bit in the numbers. You can see it in some of the statistics. But it's not all going to be voluntary or, you know, based on our own desire in order to try and save more. And we know how hard it is. Banks aren't going to lend to us the way that they did before. What banks learned is that we're a risky asset. Now, what did they learn during the Great Depression? So the consumer installment revolution, really started in the 1920s. I mean, it had been going on before, and we had been sort of the furniture makers. They'd started to do consumer credit. But it really started in the 1920s, and the major player was General Motors Acceptance Corporation, GMAC. And there may be some fitting history here where GMC was the really the force that created the consumer installment revolution. And, of course, GMAC, with the end of the consumer revolution, is sputtering into history. We're sort of keeping it alive on life support. So, because it was a real shift to try and get people to borrow. But the reason why the automakers had to get people to borrow more to buy cars was that it would take a long time to work in a factory to make enough money, or work on the farm to make enough money to buy a car. And so they really worked hard, consumer installment revolution. And I don't know how many of you read this wonderful series of books by Robert and Helen Lind called Middletown. And so they, 1924, they did all this research. It was funded by the Rockefellers. They wanted to come and, you know, really look at middle America. So they picked Middletown. That was the name that they gave the town, which is actually Muncie, Indiana. And they went there in 1924, and they lived there for a year, and they did all these surveys, and it's a wonderful book about religion and work, and it's all divided. And the thing that they were so upset about was that people were borrowing. They were borrowing to buy homes. They were borrowing to buy their cars. They were borrowing to have their furniture. And so this was going to be an absolute disaster. When the downturn came, it was all going to blow up. So that they did that in 1924. It was published in 1929. So Robert Lind went back. In 1935, he was expecting to see, you know, all his debts gone bad. And what he learned is hardly any of the debt went bad. And in 1929, out of every 100 automobiles sold on installment, 3 went into default. In 1932-33, the depths of the Great Depression, only 5 out of every 100 went into default. And in 1948, the Census Bureau did a study that consumer loans were safer than money in the bank. That's because a lot of banks went poof, and there was no Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And what it turned out, and this is what Robert Lind found out, you know, you'd feed your family less, you wouldn't take them to the doctor, you wouldn't take them to the dentist, but you were not going to give up that car. Okay? You were not. All right, so you go through the Great Depression, you go through World War II, what have the banks learned? They learned that the consumer is a wonderful person to lend to. Well, what have they learned coming out of this experience? You're really risky. And you have so many avenues of debt that all the old models are falling apart. I mean, this was years ago. But it sort of shows that, you know, it used to be that, why is it when you bought a home, you got a credit card? Well, that meant you were creditworthy. And then, and this was in the 1990s, all of a sudden the default rate on these homeowner credit cards started to really rise. What was going on here? Well, it turns out you wanted to start a business. Hey, you gave me a credit card. No problem. Go out and start your own business. You didn't have to go talk to a banker. Well, the default rate went up a lot higher. So again, these models haven't adjusted yet to the changes. We're a risky asset. And it's going to take, you know, the banking system has really been hammered. It didn't collapse. Stocks have revived a lot. But it's going to take them a long time to restore their balance sheets. So they're not going to want to lend to us the way they did before. And the regulators have been deeply embarrassed. I mean, they've just been embarrassed. And they're in that period of time that can last for a while, which says, not on my watch. And be very, very wary of letting people lend. And I was up at a economic conference up in St. Cloud State University. And that was one of the themes that came out of there, is that clearly the regulators are enforcing among the smaller banks a certain amount of conservatism in terms of their lending. So we're financially aware of how much we are at risk to a downturn. And it's very hard to come up with a scenario where we're going to be making much money, you know, much money in terms of increases. And then the banks are not going to lend to us. And the regulators, they're going to say, hey, stay conservative. Now, the thing is, at this point, these are sort of more negative forces that are weighing us, that are, you know, encouraging us to save more. But, you know, no one likes to be told to be limited. You can't do things. You know, we're an optimistic people. And, you know, one of the things about borrowing is that borrowing is an incredibly optimistic act. I mean, if you think about it, you buy a home, you get a fixed rate 30-year mortgage, you know, and at some level you believe over the next 30 years you're going to be able to pay that mortgage. I mean, that's really optimistic. And this partially came home to me when I was doing research for the book, and I knew that my parents had moved to Levittown in 1949. So Levittown was the, you know, the original suburb, Catcher in the Rye, and that was Levittown. And my parents, they were living in a place where my dad had to kneel in order to shave. And so it was, you know, it was kind of crowded. And, you know, moving to Levittown was a real step up. I mean, it had a refrigerator, it had two bedrooms, it had radiant heat. I mean, my mom just can go on and on and on. What I didn't know, and this is what I learned while I was doing the research for the book, is that my dad's father, my grandfather, was furious at his son. Wouldn't talk to him for a long time because he had borrowed to buy a home. Now, in the 1920s, my grandfather worked for Anacostia Copper, which was the giant copper company, and he was a bookkeeper there. There were 60 bookkeepers in Yonkers. And during the Great Depression, they fired handful. Two were left. He was one of the two. Now, in the 1920s, he had bought a home. Extended Irish Catholic family moved into the home. Now, back then, almost everybody, I think it was about 80% of all mortgages, were interest-only mortgages, which, by the way, is proof positive it only takes 80 years for a really bad idea to return. Okay? So he lost the home. An extended Irish Catholic family ended up moving into a two-bedroom apartment, and they never owned again. As an aside, it took him 20 years, but he actually paid off the mortgage that he owed. Even though he didn't have to, there's no legal obligation whatsoever. So he was furious. Borrowing was going to ruin his family. And my parents, you know, they'd come out of the Depression, they'd come out of World War II, they had a family, you know, they were optimistic. So in thinking and researching this story, one of the things that I think that came out of the Great Recession, and you can look at it a number of different ways, but part of it is people sort of looking at their home or their apartment and saying, why do I have all this stuff? You know, do I really need this? I knew at the time I bought that I really wanted it, but why do I have it? Because there's been another major trend that's been going on at the same time that we've been having this consumer borrowing boom. And it's kind of an ugly term, but it's called sustainability. And it means a lot of different things, but it means a concern about what is your carbon footprint? What is your impact on the planet? What about your local businesses? What about the vibrancy of your community and your neighborhood? And sustainability has moved from the fringes of our society to the mainstream. And it really came home just how much sustainability has moved to the mainstream when Walmart imposes a sustainability index on all of its suppliers. And if you really want to know about sustainability, take your youngest on a tour of college campuses. Of course, you're on a college campus here. But sustainability is a key part of how they're living, is a key part of any campus. Governments are running short of money right now, but again, sustainability. And there's all kinds of greenwash, there's all kinds of hypocrisy, and nevertheless, something has really changed. And if you think about it, it's an incredibly optimistic act that you believe by being conscious by recycling, by being conscious of what you buy, of considering the impact of your purchases, that this is going to make a difference. I have no idea what's going to happen on the level of international treaties, carbon taxes, cap and trade, maybe nothing, maybe something. And yet you really believe that these actions make a difference. But on a very basic, fundamental financial level, what a lot of people learned during the Great Recession is that being green and being frugal reinforced one another, that they played off of each other. The other thing that has happened, and I went back again, Time Inc., and also looked at a lot of other researches going on, and one of the things that became clear is that in previous period of time, when people said we're going to be frugal, what they were really saying is I'm going to be cheap. So I'm going to buy as big a bag of rice as I possibly can for as cheap a price as I can. I'm going to feed my family this rice until they run out of the house screaming. And then I'm going to buy cans of tuna fish. That's not being frugal. You know, being frugal is, yes, you're going to buy something, but you don't buy things that are disposable. You buy things that have value. You buy things you want to keep for a period of time. It's about home-cooked meals. It's about experiences. It's about less being disposable, being quick, being fast, not being considerate. So I think frugality is very, very different from being cheap, because nobody does want on their tombstone to say, "I was a cheapskate." You just don't want that. But you know, the etymology, if I said that word right, of frugality is virtue. Bless you. And so I think that there is really something that is different about being green and being frugal than how it has been treated in the past, and that this is really a positive action that reinforces what we want to be doing. Now, there also are a couple of implications that come out of this that I think reinforce the message, not directly on it. And these are some personal finance notes that I wanted to leave with you. The first, and what came out of the research, I've been moving in this direction over a period of time, but that the core of any household's financial plan should be giving. And you know, it may not be the biggest part, and it probably isn't the biggest part of your household income. I mean, if you look at it, you know, in terms of your savings, you try and put money, you know, the biggest part is probably your retirement savings plan, the 403B, the 401K, the IRA, and then, you know, maybe a 529 if you have youngsters trying to save for their college, trying to do emergency savings, you know, trying to find some money, and, you know, trying to give. But the reason why giving, I would argue, should be the core of all your financial planning is that it asks all the right questions. What am I doing? What impact do I want to have? Where do I want to make a difference? Do I want to support this business, or do I want to support this business? Is this the kind of activity that I approve of? And we ask ourselves all those questions when we're trying to think about our charitable giving. And if we put that at the core of a financial plan, I think it spills over into all our savings and all our spending decisions. And it reinforces a certain outlook that leads toward more frugality. And frugality, by the way, again, it's not only that it's not cheapness. Savings is also not necessarily denial. Who here, or at least I have, you know, hasn't thought, boy, if I had a little more money, there's some incredible opportunities that have opened up during this period of time. So savings is also, if you have savings, it allows you to take advantage of reasonable risks, reasonable opportunities. The other thing I would argue is to keep it simple in all financial planning. You know, one of the things that has, I think, evolved over time is that our lives have become more complicated and more demanding. Our employers demand more of our time. They just do, all right? They just demand more of our time. For my parents, you know, they would come home, they'd watch Walter Cronkite, they'd have a scotch, we'd go off and do our homework. Now, if you have kids, you're supposed to be involved with their homework. You're supposed to engage with their homework. And you're supposed to talk to your partner. And, you know, I mean, these are demands. And, you know, it's not only that you get up in the morning and you take a shower and you brush your teeth. Now you're supposed to floss. And you're going to go for a run. And you're going to diet. And you're going to, you know, all these things that we are supposed to be doing. And on top of that, you're going to be a Wall Street trader. You have to keep your finances really simple. What are you trying to accomplish with the money? What is it you're really trying to do? And yes, you may leave some opportunities on the wayside. But most of the time when people are telling you about this complicated strategy that they have employed, what they haven't told you is most of them didn't work out. But one of them may. So our lives are demanding. They're important things. We want to volunteer in our community. We want to be voting in our community. We want to be active citizens. We're trying to understand this healthcare bill. We're trying to raise our families. We're trying to work. Keep the finances simple to support those activities as opposed to trying to add that on top of everything else. And the final thing is, and this is, I think, more it's going to be for all of us, but particularly for younger people, is to change the way we think about savings. You know, one of the things that comes out of the past 8 years is that we've had two bear markets in 8 years and two recessions. I think a lot of people have come out of this and said, you know what, I probably can't save enough to maintain my standard of living in retirement. I have to think about this a little differently. And I'm going to have to work longer. And what does that really mean? I think part of working longer is, on the one hand, shifts the way we think about investment. Because, you know, so investing and saving for retirement has been dominated by a Wall Street perspective. How much in stocks? How much in bonds? What's your asset allocation? What's your diversification? And all these things are important. And by the way, nothing that I'm saying is you don't do the full retirement savings plan. But I would argue that equally important and perhaps more important is an investment in your education, your skills, and what do you want to be doing. And this came home to me, a wonderful woman. She was the number three. She retired, number three in the University of California system. And she's a formidable force. And she's very formidable in the Bay Area, lives in the Bay Area, and a number of the environmental organizations. And she's very valued. And we were having a conversation. He said, you know, we really have this problem. We have these people. They're 70 years old. They've had these incredible careers. They're really wonderful people. They show up, but we don't know them. And they show up and say, I've got all the skill. I want to work for you. And you look at them. And you go, well, I guess you can, you can answer the phones. You can help us with some mailings. But then she says, there are some people, they don't spend much time. But, you know, 10 years before retirement, they start spending some time with us. And, boy, we can't wait for them to retire. Because when they walk in the door, we know what they can do. We know who they are. And we put them to work right away. And so I think investing in what is it you want to be doing when you say goodbye to your colleagues for the last time, when you say goodbye for that boss, because you do want to get out of the environment and you want to be doing something different, that's the kind of investment as you enter in your older years to be making. And that's where I think a lot of the return. The other side of it is so much of our savings has been dominated by saving for retirement. And for younger people, I think the reason why you want to save is to fund a lot of career shifts during a lifetime. Some of them are going to be imposed on you. Some of them you want to do voluntarily. So not all savings goes into the tax-deferred retirement savings plan, but outside. So that you can decide, I want to pursue this career opportunity. I want to try this out. And it's over a lifetime. Your earnings may be flatter, but if you're working longer, your standard of living is exactly the same. So those are my remarks. And I'd love to open it up for challenges, brickbats, addendums, whatever you would like. And I believe we have three microphones that are going around.
Exactly. We'll be all over. So we'll ask you, where's the first question? Who wants to start?
And we go back there.
Are you there, Margie?
No,
not yet.
Okay, I see. All right, sorry.
Arlene, it is.
Thank you. I'm a little frugal. And I wanted to also suggest that we kind of were in a fairy godmother type of mindset with all the home equity loans.
Yes.
And getting something for nothing. And I don't mean to blame people, but it's just kind of like if it's too good to be true, it's too good to be true.
Yeah, I think it's right. And I do think that it's a lesson a lot of people have learned. One of the things that's really striking is if you look at a lot of the problems right now, they're revolving around home equity loans. This is for people who aren't going to go into foreclosure or short sale, but are just having trouble with debt, paying it off. A lot of it is really surrounding the home equity loan at this point.
Some people a few years ago were saying that with all the baby boomers retiring, there were not going to be enough workers come about 2015 or 2018 or something like that. And so maybe when those years come, the workers really will get an increase in wage because the employers will be searching for so many people, they'll have to increase their wage?
Well, I think you're right. So there's a pretty compelling demographic argument that if you go out to 2008 to 2018, there's a recent study that came out. And depending on if you assume that the labor force participation rate remains the same, you assume that our immigration policy remains the same, and you assume that people retire at the same age that they've been doing in the recent decade, somewhere between 5 and 7 million jobs go begging. And so that's about a 30-40% shortage on from the employer's point of view. That's not going to happen. And one way that they can deal with it is to raise wages. The other thing that they may do, though, is they may also, and this is where I think there's a lot of thinking going on, they may very well change the way that they reward employees. So younger employees may get better, maybe more in terms of income, job promotion. Older employees may be rewarded more in terms of job flexibility and in terms of making a difference, having tasks that make a difference, as opposed to you're going to get a higher wage or you're going to get a promotion. And so I think it may show up for younger people, hopefully, that they will start getting better wage increases. That's the optimistic picture. But I think it's going to take us a while to get there.
We have a question in the back here.
Early in your talk, you indicated that you believed we had narrowly avoided a depression and that the measures that were taken were considered pretty onerous by all involved. Last month, the speaker held forth that Wall Street profits the most when some segment of the economy, either national or world, is in great disarray. Do you think that Wall Street would have preferred an actual depression to what happened?
No, absolutely not. I don't think that Wall Street would have preferred a depression, and mainly because they're not that evil. I just don't believe that.
Pretty bad,
I truly
but not that
don't.
Bad.
So that's really one. You know, that's really one very simple, basic point. The other point is you don't know who's going to get washed away, and most firms would have been washed away in a Great Depression. And so, no, I think that we came close. We averted it. There was a very, Joseph Nocera is a wonderful columnist for the New York Times, and he told this very powerful story. This is now we're back in 2008, and he was allowed into J.P. Morgan, which had just gotten bailed out, held for its employees with a senior executive, and he didn't identify, but it was pretty clear it was Jamie Dimon who was talking. And one of the employees got up and said, "Why aren't we lending more?" And whoever was the executive said, "Because we don't know if this is a garden variety recession or a Great Depression." And so, no, a Great Depression, credit crunch washes away many firms. And so it's not something they would have wanted. Now, the bailout, it turns out, bailouts are really ugly. You hold your nose. And they profited by savers got paid. I don't know how many of you looked at your bank accounts. What are you making on your savings? That's how you bailed out the banking system.
We have a question over here.
I guess I'm a senior, and I'm concerned about employment.
Yeah.
A lot of us go into retirement, and we think it's a wonderful thing, and we get whatever payment for doing that. But I'm bored. I really want to work.
Yeah.
I have all these skills and knowledge, and yet here I am. I'm looking around here. I think there's a few of us in this room. But I guess my question to you is, how do we tap into senioritis, or whatever you want to call it, and put them to work with the younger, up-and-coming generation?
Yeah. No, and I think that it's really important. It's something that you said is one of the reasons why I think you know, part of it is financial, but also why people are going to want to work longer. It's a major social environment. I mean, you have conversations, you celebrate birthdays,
no,
you
I'm
cry
good.
Over
just
divorces. Someone cares whether you show up or not. So, I mean, I think the sort of social environment, the engagement of work has been underestimated. Economists tend to look at things in terms of income. You know, what is that aspect? But I think there's a very important social aspect of work and giving back. That really does matter. So you're seeing some movement. There's a group in San Francisco called Civic Ventures, headed up by Mark Friedman, Encore Careers. I don't know if you've heard about this. We're encouraging people to do second or third careers. They got a small amount of money passed in Congress in a bill now where AmeriCorps now has a program for those who are 50 and above. 50 and older. A lot of school systems are trying to tap into the elderly to try and get them. I actually think we're at a very early stage of trying to figure out part of what we were talking about earlier in terms of some demographics are going to force employers. Look, employers aren't going to do anything unless they're kind of forced to, or not forced to by government regulation or mandate, but by economics, the underlying economic competitive pressure. One of the things that employers are starting to realize, and it's sort of masked by this terrible environment that we're in and the high unemployment rate, is there's a lot of brain power walking out the door. I mean, too much brain power walking out the door. So, you know, we've sort of had, and I would draw an analogy to what corporate companies had to adjust to with women coming into the workforce and the differences that it made in terms of how benefits were overhauled over a period of time. It took a long period of time, but over a period of time, and changes that happened in power structures, all kinds of things. I think it's going to be the same thing with senior citizens. The problem is, right now, with a 9.7% unemployment rate, it's really difficult to see that. And it's really difficult to say anything much optimistic, except for that I think as time goes on, this is the story. Because you and everyone in this room is the most educated generation in history. There's never been anything like it. And to say that we're just going to have that walk out the door, I think is not only a big mistake, it's not going to happen.
A question in the back and out front here.
Hi there. Great talk tonight. Quick question for you is that I'm in one of the demographics you mentioned, mid-30s. And so I started investing back in the 90s, tech bubble crash. Then we had 9/11. Then we've had the latest recession. But my financial planners who I talk to keep saying, oh, the market goes up, it goes down, but it's always going up. I'm wondering, though, in your opinion, I'm going to put you on the spot here with your crystal ball. So are the last 10 to 12 years an aberration, or is this the new norm and the financial planning community just doesn't want to admit it?
Yeah, the market, it went up 72% over the past year. No. I'm actually quite optimistic about the stock market. And this is the way I look at it. And it's not a particularly sophisticated view. It's a very simple view, which is that you're essentially, if you buy a broadly diversified portfolio, and hopefully it's an index fund, so you're paying very low fees, you're essentially buying a stake in the economy. If the economy grows, your portfolio grows. If the economy doesn't grow, your portfolio doesn't grow in terms of the stock portion. And if you look at the business cycle expansion of the 2000s, it's not that surprising that the stock portfolio didn't grow. I'm actually incredibly optimistic about the future of the U.S. economy. And although there is, you have to be a little bit careful, but so stock returns in the 1930s were 2% adjusted for inflation. And, companies were paying dividends in the 1950s of 6-7%. And people were putting their money into savings and loans where they're getting paid 3% and taking out a 6% mortgage. And the banker was on the golf course at 3. It was not a bad deal. But the stock return in the 1950s was around, adjusted for inflation, is around 15-16%. So, I think there's, and one other way also of looking at this economy, what happened in the 2000s, and there were a lot of things that happened. But one of the puzzles, and I throw this out as a puzzle to think about. In the 1980s, the personal, there was always this thing, okay, we got all these personal computers, we got all these computers, we see them everywhere but in the productivity statistics. And it was a famous quote by Nobel laureate Robert Solow. Well, part of what would happen is companies actually started figuring out in the 80s. There was the PC revolution. There was a lot of innovation around it. And then in the 90s, a lot of that innovation came home to roost. Plus, we had the internet. I mean, Netscape went public 1995. All of a sudden, everyone goes, there's commercial possibilities here. Now, think about the 2000s. What's the innovation that has seized the attention? The iPhone. I mean, and there's nothing against the iPhone, because it actually, it is sort of transformative in certain ways, but it's not leading to a whole lot of job creation. Now, when does that happen? I'm relatively optimistic that at some point there will be an innovation that will generate it, but I don't know when. I do know that before 1995, that there was no such thing as a webmaster. And if you go back to very good, there's a really good economist, 1968 long-term economic forecast about job creation. About two-thirds of those jobs didn't exist. They kind of missed. So that's my optimistic answer. But in terms of do I have a, could it be another couple of years? Here's the thing. The risk of stocks is that they don't go up. And it's for real. Because it's what you're really owning is it's the risk to entrepreneurship. And there's no guarantee it's going to pay off. And that's why stocks are risky.
I have to preface this question by telling you it's probably one of the more mundane, boring questions that you...
I love mundane, boring questions.
You get asked a lot, but it has to do with the unemployment rate. What is your best guess for what's going to happen in the near term with the unemployment rate, both nationally, and would it be any different for Minnesota?
Well, if you take sort of Ben Bernanke as being a benchmark, So he's talking about, in the question people are saying, probably 2013 to get the unemployment rate down to 6%. And there's a lot of despair that you would get the unemployment rate ever below 6% again. That part I actually don't agree on. But I do think that if you're talking about a 6% unemployment rate, you know, it's somewhere somewhere between 2011, 12, and 13. It's in that time frame. And it's very difficult to come up with a scenario of rapid employment growth. Hopefully I'm wrong. We could have some sort of innovation that could just suddenly emerge on the scene. Part of it has to do with globalization. A lot of the job growth will be overseas as opposed to here. And that's how you can have this sort of weird dichotomy where corporate profits, if you look at corporate profits for the S&P 500, can be very, very strong. And I think corporate profits are really strong, are going to continue to be strong, but they're benefiting not just from what's happening here, but elsewhere around the global economy. And therefore, our unemployment rate can also be relatively weak, even while corporate profits are strong.
Way in the back there.
My wife and I have been Schedule C self-employed freelancers for the last 10 years. So playing off the question about the board senior a little bit, what is the big picture in terms of people just saying, hey, I'm not going to wait for an opportunity to go up. I'm going to sit down and start doing something. And what is the big picture as far as the Schedule C type freelance sector? Is there such a thing? And does it, where's it going?
You know, there's like three different answers that I can give to that. One is, I think for every young person who has graduated from college, is out in the job market today, hopefully has a job, I think that if you don't have a sideline job, you should. And I think that's I think there's some evidence that that's happening more and more. So in one sense, I think people are more aware that they're going to need to either have a sideline business or have some sort of freelance income in addition to what else they're doing. You know, my worry is if you take a look at what's happening now, the healthcare thing may totally change this, may at least partially change what's going on. But we really are creating a large segment of our workforce that is temporary, contract, freelance, with no retirement benefits and no healthcare benefits. And it's one of the more disturbing trends that's going on in our economy. It's also why one of the reasons why I think anyone who's talking about repeal of healthcare reform, it's not going to happen. You know, there's some underlying fundamental economic reasons why we're moving in that direction. So I think that for a lot of people, they're forced into it. It's a tough environment. At the same time, something has happened in our economy in terms of the internet, in terms of companies being more willing to work with satellites, work with Schedule C, work with freelancers. So it kind of depends on where you are. You know, for some people, I think if you want to be that entrepreneur, it's a good environment. If you don't want to be that entrepreneur, that's how you survive.
Well, I'd like to challenge you to be a little more specific on where this optimism long-term comes in the United States. And my question is, because really it's the old thing that you get with the stocks, you cannot predict the future, you can't predict the future based upon past earnings. And I know that implicit in the American psyche has always been the idea that we can move forward.
Yeah.
And you don't always see what the engine is. You don't see if it's the internet. You don't always see where that engine is, but it's going to be there and it's going to take over and it's going to be better. And I try to instill that belief in my children who are in their late 20s and who do not have particularly productive jobs. And I say, and I try to be optimistic, but frankly, I'm not sure that I should be. Your new frugality takes money out of the economy, and it teaches, not you individually, but this idea kind of takes us out of the marketplace. 70% of the American gross national product, as I understand it, is consumer driven. So the frugality is being taken out of there. Tremendous amount of credit out there that people are way overextended. We're still not working through all the credit card debt. Same time, we've got health insurance. That's a huge thing, but we don't have retirement plans. Nobody has defined benefits anymore. Many people have the old structures that were there, jobs that you could rely on, good paying jobs, not some job that you can grab in the, you know, for 3 months here or 6 months there. Right. I would like to know, and if the large companies in this country are going to be going overseas for the profit, then if you're invested in those companies, perhaps you can make the money. But I guess I'll cut it short now. Okay. Where is the middle American in this in 20 years, and why are you so specifically, or is there any specific reason for optimism? Or is it only faith-based?
Do I get another hour? Yes, there's a couple of reasons for the optimism that I think are not necessarily just faith-based, so maybe a little bit. First of all, the 70% figure. When you look at that 70% figure, actually 20% of that, so you knock yourself down right away to about 50%, is healthcare spending. That's the way the government accounts. So healthcare spending is considered consumer consumption. Most of us don't think of it that way. I mean, that's kind of like not part of. So, you know, we think more about the car, you know, going to the cars, going to the mall. You know, that's sort of classic consumer behavior. It's a smaller part, but it's still a huge part. But my basic answer is never underestimate the power of the American entrepreneur to take your money. All right? And I mean this. So one of the things that I just find absolutely stunning is if you go to Grand and Victoria, you can't get parking because there's a yoga studio there. And there's now opening up, it's going to open up, I think, next month, there's a personal training studio that is opening up there. And what is happening is that, you know, 20 years ago, so it was actually 30 years ago, I tried yoga. I failed miserably. And, you know, I knew some people who did it, and just, you know, but now yoga's a career. Yoga is a job. We have masseuse is a job. And we used to have different connotations when someone said that they gave massages. Now, you know, they come to Minnesota Public Radio. I think it's every Wednesday or Thursday. Someone comes. This is their job. They go around to different offices, and they give people massages. It's an incredible change in our life. Wellness and health is a giant entrepreneurial opportunity that lots of people are moving into. One aspect of us working longer, you know what? People don't want to show up without teeth. You don't want to sit in a meeting and be gap-toothed. Well, all of a sudden, it turns out that dental companies are really doing a lot of work in this area. And they're starting to make a lot of money. And I think that the whole artificial hip, the artificial knee, because people are going to want to be able to move around work a lot more. So I think that, first of all, I don't underestimate the American entrepreneur. And I do think that, you know, look, what do wealthy societies spend their money on? There are two things wealthy societies increasingly spend their money on, education and healthcare. And if you look at this recession that we went through, I think every month, I think there was one month where this is not the case, but every month, healthcare employment grew. And this is one of the most, you know, everyone keeps talking about we can't afford healthcare. We can't afford. What are they, nuts? This is one of the most dynamic sectors of our economy. It's globally competitive. It's a huge employer. It is largely, you know, yes, the factory middle class job has largely disappeared in the United States, but where is the middle class job today? It's in healthcare and it's in education. So part of my optimism is that is the entrepreneur, is education and healthcare, some of these trends don't bother me. Where I get pessimistic in the dark mood of the night is that so many of our problems, I think, if you put a group of men and women in a back room, you could solve Social Security in a day. A couple cigars, a couple glasses of whiskey, it'd be over with. Because we all know what the solution is. And, you know, when Paulson tried, when he, you know, after the whole debacle over privatization, and then he did try, what he basically came with is a solution everyone knows eventually we're going to do. So we can solve this problem. Our politics, and I think a lot of despair, is over the fact that our politics have gotten so vicious and the national discussion has gotten so uncivil. What I look at and what I emphasize is more, you know, take a look at the workplace. This is one of our major institutions. It's one of our major institutions. And, you know, that is an institution, by and large, not being a Pollyanna, where it doesn't matter what your sexual orientation is. It doesn't matter what your race is. It doesn't matter what your gender is. is an incredible institution for creating wealth and for giving people choice. And I don't see anything yet that has changed that. But that's faith.
Yes, I want to be optimistic as well. And actually, I'm retiring in 6 days, so I'm very
optimistic.
So you
are optimistic.
And, yeah, and life is great for me. But I, too, have children.
Yes.
Who one is a doctor with a huge loan, and there was a health issue. And anyway, I'm worried about the children, and I'm worried about a backlash from our youth, because I think they aren't going to have the opportunities, and I'm not convinced that yoga is going to provide the kind of employment that I've been allowed to have.
No.
And I'm not convinced. I'm sorry. I want to be optimistic.
Yeah.
I am a Pollyanna. But for my children, I'm very worried.
No, and I
and
think
I've
that...
experienced some very significant economic measures in which I've been involved to help them. So you please help me.
Yes. No, and I and
be
I think that anybody with children is concerned. And you know, as I said, the I think it is, you know, there's so many disturbing numbers that come out of the period of time that we've been through. But 11% decline in real wages over a decade for people who are doing the right thing is really a disturbing. I mean, it's truly disturbing. I mean, they went to a college, they got a college education. And there are, you know, among the things that does really worry me is that, you know, clearly we've relied too much on loans in terms of our educational system. And we just have. People are graduating with too much debt overall. I actually don't understand the medical profession at this point with that kind of a debt burden. It just really doesn't make any logical sense to me. So I'm not, you know, I'm not minimizing any of that. But what I do think, and one of the things is, and it really was struck me as I was traveling around the country on a book tour, is how many young people are green and are frugal. And the fact of the matter is, on the one hand, they have no choice for some of the reasons that you're giving. And the other hand, it's what they've grown up with. And it's part of it. It's a belief system. And so it's not all bad and it's not all negative. But I do think that young people really do face a lot of difficult issues between the debts that they've had to take on to get their education. And, you know, the debts get bigger if they become professionals. But at the same time, if you're a doctor, you can work for a long time.
We go from your far right to your far left. Isn't that the way it goes here?
Yeah.
Far left, that's where I am. I'm the far left. Just look at my license plate. It's okay. Got a statement and a suggestion. Because as I'm listening to my friends and colleagues in this room, and I think of the friends that I have, I half of them, maybe more than half, come from a fear-based view of the world. They really are afraid. There are some people, and the other side seem to be even hesitant, so that even as that young woman who's just ready to retire, she wasn't able to say, I am optimistic. She was saying, I think I'm optimistic. So mm-hmm. She's still not there. I think part of the work that we have, that I have, and I think that my friends have, is somehow to be able to help those friends of ours pass that fear that has been in the ether in which we've been breathing for the last certainly 8 to 10 years. And that is kind of that's a job by itself. And if we are more conscious of that, I think we can make a change. And here's the suggestion. I knew the title of your book to be The New Frugality. My initial reaction was to that was a fear-based book. I would much rather have seen it entitled The Good Frugality, or, you know, The Better Frugality, or The Frugality of a Better Future. That, I think, would be a suggestion for your next book.
I'll keep that in mind. Thank you.
Chris, way in the back over here. Yeah. Can you comment at all on frugality and how it applies to wage disparities? I mean, you mentioned just a minute ago about younger people and growing up with green and thinking, and yet last month we had someone speak and talking about the bonuses that Wall Street again paid themselves. And even you look at this university, which just got a big cut in what their funding was, and yet we're going to increase the amount that we pay for the stars, the basketball coach, the football coach. And it seems that we've got that disparity is growing, not shrinking. And it's great to have the frugality on the low end, but what about the rest of the people? It's almost
right. Well, you know, I mean, there's an element where, look, people who don't have much money, by definition, are frugal. I mean, they are. And we're all learning from them. So to some extent, this is not a message for them because it's what they live. And they go to thrift stores. I mean, they just do. This is part of what they do. So, and I think that's very important. They live a frugal lifestyle as it is. In terms of Wall Street, they think they're being frugal. They do. They're down to four homes. They got rid of the fifth. In all seriousness, one of the most disturbing trends of the past 25 years has been the rise of income inequality. And it has been going on for a long period of time. And, you know, to some extent, there was a very positive impact from the rise of inequality because it sent a message. And the message that it sent, the message was received, was go to college, that there were rewards to a college education. So the rise in inequality was not all bad. And what was really striking is it spent 6 months on and off in Chicago and the housing projects that are coming down and the developments that are rebuilding. And in the Chicago housing projects, the message about going to college is there. When we went to Kentucky and we were traveling in Appalachia, there wasn't a hollow that you couldn't go to that the parents didn't want their kids to go to college. So that message has gotten out there. So that's the positive side, I think, of the increase in inequality. However, it's continued to go. And to a large extent, when I said that wages haven't gone anywhere, what's the more accurate statement is wages haven't gone anywhere for 80 to 85% of the workforce. And then for 15% of the workforce, 10% of the workforce it has. And they've been increasing. I think that for most middle-income folks, which is really what this book is targeted for, whether they're younger or they're middle-aged or they're older, they're embracing a new frugality because that's what they can do at this point in time. And what's really amazing is how fast households have adjusted. It's really pretty incredible. So the inequality is a pressure on them. It fits right into my theme. But what, you know, what part of what we do is we, you know, got all kinds of cliches are coming, but not completely finishing them. But we turn a necessity into a virtue. And that's partly what the new frugality is. But at the end, we have more freedom and we have more choice. The inequality, the way that we solve the inequality, in the end, is going to be through the education system and through the tax system. This is about having greater control over your life and making a difference in terms of the planet going forward.
Yeah, Mr. Farrell, I think you made a good case as to why people, at least in the near term, will work to avoid greater debt. Right. But I don't really understand your case as to why people will be saving more. And I mean cash saving, equities. I mean money in the bank. I don't see that as near term, maybe not even long term, in this society today. Can you elaborate on your thoughts?
I mean, part of it, I mean, you're right to a lot of the focus right now is on paying down debt, which is a form of savings. But you're paying down the debt, you're reducing your debt burden. But the, you know, the personal savings rate, which has all kinds of flaws to it, but it's a kind of nice sort of measure. What personal savings rate is income minus consumption. So you just come in. And it went down to around 1%. And it's fluctuated, but it's between 4 and 5%. So people are saving more. And where I see people continuing to save is, look, the unemployment insurance system isn't that good. And people are aware of that. You're not getting wage increases. You're at risk of a pay cut. So the focus right now, after the borrowing boom that we've been going through, is to reduce your debt level, to get rid of the credit card debt, to get rid of the home equity loan, to get your debts more manageable so that you have a better margin of safety. But that is a form, that is savings. That is a way of savings and of making the household. Plus, we are actually seeing in the numbers, despite the fact that people are being paid nothing, I mean, they're paying nothing on their savings, have actually increased their savings during this period of time. Although to a large extent, you may even be losing money after you take into account fees that are being charged to you.
I have a comment and sort of a question. I mean, one comment I think that we have no historical perspective. When you feel pessimistic, think of what someone felt like about 1935 in the midst of the Depression and the rise of a fascist Europe and Japan invading China. And I think the world looked pretty grim. And I don't think we're anywhere near that right now.
Right.
Secondly, I think one of the things, and you touched on this, is this income disparity. And we have fought two wars now with no income tax increase, which is, we've had cuts, which is just ridiculous. And it's ruining our economy. And we have to face up to the fact that if we're going to fight a war, we have to pay for it. And we're going to have to increase tax, and we're going to need a more graduated tax. In World War II, people paid 90% on the last dollar. And I think we need to be back somewhere in that area to get our house back in order. And then we need more financial regulation. The credit card debt is usury, and that ought to be controlled more rigidly, that you can't charge somebody 30% for crying out loud and get that from the mob. And then that we should put Glass-Steagall back in place so these banks can't play with our money. And so we need more and more rigorous control from Washington or from the government, and we need a better tax structure.
Well, one thing... And I want to link what you just said to what you had said earlier about optimism. And here, I think, is a measure or a test for whether or not to be optimistic or pessimistic. Now, to be absolutely clear, I have no problem with the debt and the deficit that we've taken on during this period of time. Absolutely none. All right? I think that it was the necessary cost in order to avert a depression. And I think people, as you mentioned, 1935, I mean, look, we're talking about an unemployment rate significantly worse than we have right now. So I think the debt deficit, that's fine. But let's go several years down the road. It's still pretty amazing, you know, when George Bush the first, you know, and he used that expression, you know, talking about red ink as far as the eye can see. And yet between actions that Bush the first took and Clinton took, that, you know, it took a period of time, but by 1998, we had the first budget surplus since 1968. So you now have a commission that's been gotten together. Nobody likes it. People are being disparaging of it. But to me, that is really the test of American institutions. And the test of American institutions is most of the time when there has been a threat to wealth, we've done the right thing. The political institutions have adapted. So the test going forward is if, and I think we do need to have a credible plan because the long-term budget deficit is unsustainable. So what is the credible plan over a period of time that brings it down to a more sustainable level? And it's not going to be done on the tax side solely, and it's not going to be done on the cutting side solely. If we're not able to do what Bush 1 and Clinton were able to do, then I think you have a very pessimistic case. If we're able to do what Bush and Clinton were able to do, I think you have an extremely optimistic future.
Hi, I'd like to, again, go back. You talked about education and our young people, mm-hmm. And probably how, I guess, to see or how to find, maybe speaking to to that woman over on that side who is worried about her own kids.
Right.
Okay. For 8 to 10 years, most of the students have been forced to finance their education by heavy loans, and many of them dropped out because they could no longer continue that basis. So you still have the loans, but you have no degree, and even if you have a degree, you're probably getting a sandwich delivery job. On top of that, we've now added a deficit that they're going to have to live with for a long time, and I don't know how they're going to finance it. I'm just wondering, how can we instill? Yes, I think education is important. Our next group of young people coming up, how are we going to instill optimism? How are we going to direct them to colleges? I think a lot of them don't want to go there because they don't know how they're going to finance it. And that optimism when they see what's on their backs in terms of loan and debt.
Here's my problem. Community colleges are bursting at the seams. College applications are running at record levels. I mean, the mess of people are going to college. Now, there's a question about graduating. And that's really a big issue. But I do think that people are going to college. And we have to be, I would be wary. I mean, even in this, you know, terrible recession, the young college educated worker still has only a 5% unemployment rate. I mean, it's an only. But that tells you how bad off is the worker that has only a high school degree or the worker that has less than a high school degree. So I sort of have mixed feelings. I think that one of the major challenges that we have is, and you would know better, but it's like 70% of our high school graduates go on to college, at least start college. The 30% drop out, and that's what we really do need to worry about. And I do think we need to have some reforms of how do you pay for it. But if you look at the 1990s and you go through the 1990s, and you actually go through fairly well into the 2000s, a college education paid for itself. It really did. And I think it still will pay for itself. It's a tougher environment that we're in. But the wrong message to take away is that all these students aren't able to pay their debts. Most of them can. Where they can't is there certain segments of the community that I really worry about. Segments of the community such as African Americans. And if you look at the default rate among African Americans, it's a national outrage. And that's what people should be upset about. But I don't think necessarily in terms of that a whole generation is not going to be able to profit from their degree. It's going to the rate of return, the return on that investment, is going to be longer than it was for the ones in the 90s. But I still see, I don't see any evidence that there's not going to be a rate of return and that most of them aren't going to be able to pay down the debt. But it is going to be a world of different choices. You made that investment in an education, you may not be able to buy a home. And I, to me, you know what? The return on that investment on education, it's a lot higher than any return on a home.
Yeah, I worked in the community college system 32 years, but I would, a lot of people don't realize it's possible to get a 2 years of college with no debt just by working summers or part-time. Anyway, what I want to bring up, the U.S. debt, which you've already talked about, but I've looked at charts and, you know, well, the current debt and projecting forward, it's just astronomical compared to what's, you know, the long range trends. And there were about 4 years in the late 90s, Clinton, when we had a positive. Yeah. But what a lot of people don't realize, the government was collecting huge taxes on capital gains. That's the era of the stock market bubble.
Yeah.
So a lot of the taxes that were being collected by the government were based on the bubble. And people lost a lot of money right after 2000. And some of those people are still carrying forward on their tax returns the losses. You can take $3,000 right. a year. I did that for years. So we went in the late 90s when we had, I think it was 4 years. Yep. It was based on the bubble market. And so I don't know if we're going to see another bubble market where we're going to collect all this tax again.
Right.
But anyway, I think when you look at the long-term graphs, it's really scary where we are today and the near-term projections, really digging ourselves into a hole, possibly.
I agree. I mean, possibly. But again, this economy will grow again, and that will eliminate, you know, reduce some of it. And then we're going to have to increase taxes. We just are. There's no question. And we're going to have to cut spending. I mean, we just are. So I think what you're going to hear, you're starting to hear more about it. In the United States, we're going to have a VAT. It's going to come. A value-added tax. It's on its way here. It's going to take a period of time, but in the end, it's the only way you meet the obligations. But the other thing is, you know, we just passed healthcare reform. For the rest of our lives, we're going to be talking about healthcare reform on an ongoing basis. But this is just one thing, too. When you look at the long-term budget, what still is driving the unsustainability of a long-term budget is healthcare. So just as one really interesting exercise, that if we had Germany's universal healthcare system, which is a private insurance system, we do not have a long-term budget deficit. It disappears, the unsustainable portion of it. So again, I think we're going to continue to be talking about healthcare. I think that we are going to have negotiations to raise taxes. My hope, and we can all come up with it, I do think we're going to end up with a value-added tax to help pay for healthcare. My hope is that, and I don't think you can just impose it, you're going to have to give people something in return, maybe radical tax simplification, something, you know, eliminate the corporate income tax, put the value-added tax in its place, since workers pay for those corporate taxes anyway through lower wages. There would be a lot of things that we can do. If we just try and impose a VAT on top of everything else, the political system won't absorb it. But I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm not trying to minimize these challenges, but I am a little bit wary of, we're still in a really difficult time. The economy is not growing. And a lot of the things that are unsolvable because of the current nature of our political parties. And is that a long-term thing or is that a moment in our history? I don't know.
Chris in the back here.
Okay, I'm with the other two moms that are talking about their kids who've gone to college, graduated, gotten jobs. Yep. And college is astronomical. The cost of it is. I mean, it just is. For a four-year degree anywhere.
Yeah.
These kids are going to be paying, even with help, for 10 to 20 years on these loans.
That's right.
Now, are you suggesting that they pay off for 10 or 20 years and they don't get a home? They're going to have families, children, and the home prices are depressed now. Is there any way to take advantage of that and still have this other debt? I know it sounds like... But it's the American dream.
If the scenario that it's not the American dream. This is the a home is not, I don't know where that ever came from. Okay, a home is not the American dream. An American dream is to leave your children a better world than the one that you have. That's the American dream. It is not bricks and mortars. The return to a college degree, depending on how you want to do it. You can play with the numbers different ways, but the return on investment is somewhere between 15 and 20%. It leaves the stock market behind. It leaves the real estate market behind. The return on real estate investment, if you want to be optimistic, is 2.5% adjusted for inflation a year. It's essentially the same thing as a long-term bond. So I'm not saying that, I am really worried about the debt burden. And I think we have had, just as we had too much debt going into home ownership, we've had way too much debt going into paying for a college education. So I'm not justifying the current student loan system that we have, although I think the recent bill has actually improved things. But no, we're way too reliant and we need to move away from that. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that I have absolutely no reason, I do not understand why we favor home ownership over stocks, over bonds. And if we're just looking at the American dream is that you get an education, you go out there, and you know what? If you rent, it can be the smartest financial move. Rent and home ownership, they're just two competing markets. It's a stock, it's a bond. It's a home, it's a rental place. Right now, it's smart to rent. In a couple of months, it may be smart to own. But it's just the financial calculation. And education is a lifetime.
As we reflect on the importance of education in the future, I have some serious concerns what we're doing to education in this country and in our state. St. Cloud State is cutting 80 faculty and staff for next year. I have a daughter-in-law who teaches in a suburban school. She'll be teaching 40 students a day, 5 classes a day. Some schools in Minnesota are going to a 4-day week. The quality and the amount of time that we are contributing to education for these young people, it's criminal, absolutely criminal.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to, I would agree.
You spoke about wage stagflation and the increase of lack of job security.
Yeah.
But what about the change that's happened over at least 20 years of employers shifting more risk to the individual employee in terms of whether it's retirement benefits or healthcare costs? But clearly there's been a huge shift from employer to individual.
Absolutely.
Do you see people getting that and understanding that that's part of the new economic order, and do you see any change at all on employers' part to reverse that trend?
I see no change on the employer's part to reverse the trend. And I think that the message is out there for our private sector workers. I mean, I think it's been very, very clear. I think it's less clear with government workers because you still have the defined, the traditional defined benefit plan in most sectors of state and local governments and federal government, state and local governments. But no, in terms of the private sector, I think it's absolutely there. It is not a good trend. It's asking an awful lot of people to be making decisions that have implications 30 years from now in terms of stocks and bonds, which most people don't grow up knowing about. The shift that I just don't know about is what does healthcare change do? I mean, what is the supply side effect of healthcare? To what extent do people feel more comfortable leaving their employer? That job lock, which is a real phenomenon, is all of a sudden dissipated. That people feel that they can leave an employer, go to another job that would be better for them because they're no longer tied because of their healthcare. To what extent will people feel, we're just talking about the Schedule C, setting up their own business, trying to do their own business? And so those are the kinds of questions that I have that come out of this healthcare bill. I think the supply side effects have been underestimated. People put a lot of costs on the cost and some weird rhetoric and death panels and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, the supply side effect, but that's really one of the things that I would follow very closely. And that could be a positive development that would reduce the power of the employer over the employee. This is many years ago. This is about 15 years ago. But I was talking at that time, it was the world's largest corporation, multinational corporation. And we were having a conversation and they said, you know, guess where we can mistreat the workers. They actually use different language and they're a little saltier. But, you know, we'll just, where can we mistreat the workers the least in the world? So we muttered out a couple of things, and they said, Singapore. I said, Singapore? What are you talking about? He says, the worker owns the healthcare plan, and the worker owns the retirement plan, and so they can leave anytime they want, and they're not at risk of losing either one of those. So if we want reform, and I think it's one of the disappointments that happened out of healthcare for very logical reasons. I mean, I think it's, considering how hard it was to do, it's understandable. But it is a deep flaw in the U.S. healthcare system that for most people, their health insurance comes through their employer. That's the real flaw. And whether you're an economist on the left or you're an economist on the right, you agree on that. But politically, I think it would be almost impossible to sever that link, at least this time around.
Got a question in the back here.
Yeah, I think I might be the youngest person in this whole group here. But I'm 23 years old, and I just want to make a quick comment to people that are worried about their young children that are, you know, just getting out of college. And most of my optimism lies in national service. I mean, if your child isn't sure what they want to do, have them, you know, look into doing some national service. You mentioned AmeriCorps.
Yeah, my son did that, yeah.
Yep. So AmeriCorps is not going to pay for all your college debt, but it is a great way to take a quick gap year to do a lot of traveling, you know, focus on like a solid career that is going to mean something for you. So what I want to ask you is, what do you think? Do you think that's a good economic decision to go into national service? And where do you see national service in the next 5 years for people that are just starting college right now?
It's going to, from a moral point of view, I think it's a wonderful thing to do. From a very practical point of view, I think it's one of the smartest things you can do. It's becoming its own alumni association. It's becoming its own network association. And the fact of the matter is, it exposes most of the people who are doing it to aspects of life that they're not aware of or they didn't grow up around. Not everyone, but many people. And so I think there's really nothing negative to say about it. And there's a lot of positives. And, you know, typically if you're going to go on into a profession or you're sort of, you know, a lot of people still graduate from college despite all the exploration and the fact that they took on debt, not exactly sure what they want to be doing. And so it gives you more opportunity, and I think it really enriches your life. And in my generation, it was doing the Peace Corps or VISTA. Those were two major programs. AmeriCorps is essentially a much improved version of it. I think it's only going to grow. And in this administration, it's going to continue to grow and it's going to expand. As we were talking earlier, it's also expanding among us older folks. But I think from a sort of personal enrichment and career prospects and doing good in your community? Absolutely.
See why those of us in universities are... We get to retain our optimism because of hanging around young people like that. Isn't it great? And here's a dad and friend whose daughter is out doing this sort of thing now. She used to be coming to these.
Yeah, so this is probably a good way to tie on to the student that we just heard from. But my observation is that you had this large baby boom population who's now looking at retirement. So therefore, they've got maybe a natural sense to get a little frugal because now they're thinking their earning years are starting to slow down. Meanwhile, you got a baby boomlet that's just as big who are going through college right now or are 20-somethings who aren't yet truly productive in the workplace. So don't you see a lot of what we're experiencing now just tied to the fact that we have these two huge population bubbles and where they are in their lives?
That's a good question. I hadn't, I think part of it with the baby boomers, yeah, I do. And then with younger people, you know, being unsure. But I also think that these generations are having to respond to the economic environment that they're in. So as we were saying earlier, just sort of being green, being frugal among younger people being a natural message. It's not even almost a message. I think that they've already absorbed that. I think for the baby boomers, it's more of, I guess my parents weren't as dumb as I thought they were. It used to drive me nuts. My dad, every night his job was to unplug all the appliances when we were growing up. And I thought this was crazy, you know, to save on electricity. I mean, this was nuts. And as my mom announced to me, we were green. We were green before anyone knew what being green was. So I think there is a generation is relearning. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
There are lots of hands still up, but we have time for one more question. Over in the back here, please.
Probably the second youngest person here at 25. What advice could you give to a young professional with no debt, so to speak, who sees the advantages of the housing market as it is, getting a low price, but also would like to invest in a startup business of my own? Are doing both feasible, or is one or the other a better option?
You know, they're both risk. It's a risk analysis. And if you did both, what you're really doing is doubling your bet. And it is an attractive time to buy for a lot of people. But if you got a business idea, and that's what you really, you have that passion and that dream, there's a lot of risk associated with that. But there's also a lot of potential reward. And I'd be focusing myself, if it were me, and part of it is what is your judgment, but I'd be focusing on the business. But I'd be wary of taking on two distinct risks and merging them together at the same time, because even though you don't have any debt, you don't have a whole lot of resources either. And you will have a lot of debt once you embark on both ventures. So I'd be focusing in terms of thinking about your debt. You could do an analysis that says, okay, if I take on the debt to buy the home, what's my potential return? If I take on some debt in order to grow this business or start this business, what's my potential return? My own feeling is, God, if you got a business idea, now's the time to do it. If you think about it, many successful businesses, the best time to start a business is during a downturn. And there's actually a lot of research behind this. And it kind of makes sense because for two reasons. One, the cost of your inputs is less. People are more willing to strike deals with you. People are more willing to work with you. And the second thing is, by definition, you have to be conscious of your cash flow. When times are flush and times are good, you know, people charge you more. You're not as careful about your cash flow because it's all going to work out. It's all going to pay off, right? So listen to some of this conversation here. I mean, there's a fair amount of gloom going on. So that's a good time to start your business.
Go for it, huh? Chris, you've really challenged our thinking tonight. And I can tell, and you can tell, that these folks have thought about these things a lot. I don't know whether to be optimistic or pessimistic. But, hey, it's spring, and I think discussions like this give me courage that we'll figure it out. Just as you're saying. We thank you very much for
thank you. I really appreciate it. That was great. That was fun. That was good. Thank you.